Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Deputy Director of Networks at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this litigation update on Medicare drug pricing negotiations. Our speaker today is Ashley Parrish. Ashley is a partner at King & Spalding. He was one of the partners that leads the firm's appellate, constitutional, administrative law practice. He focuses practice on appellate, administrative, constitutional law, and on strategic complex litigation. He has significant experience handling administrative law cases in litigation against federal and state government agencies. After our speaker gives their presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speaker, not the Federalist Society. With that, Ashley, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Carolyn. I really appreciate it. It's nice to be with everyone here today. As Carolyn mentioned, I'm going to be talking about the pending litigation that has been filed in connection with the Inflation Reduction Act's drug pricing provisions. Just as a disclosure, I'm currently representing several clients on these issues, but my comments today are strictly my own personal views. As many of you also know, the Federalist Society, when for these webinars, often asks for sort of somewhat of a neutral perspective on the case. I'm going to try to comply with that, but I should also let you know it's a little bit challenging in this case because of how the government has chosen to defend its position in these particularly important and historic cases. There's a significant disconnect between what I think the statute requires and how the government describes the statute, both in litigation and to the public. And part of the reason for that, I think, and why these cases are so significant, is because they are part of a larger trend of the government invoking its spending and taxing powers as a way to avoid constitutional restraints that have traditionally applied to its regulatory powers. So what I thought I'd do with those caveats is proceed in four parts. First, I'll provide a brief background on the relevant constitutional requirements and the Administrative Procedure Act, which since 1946 has governed judicial review of administrative action. I start with that because I think it helps highlight why these are important cases and why the Inflation Reduction Act's drug pricing provisions are such a departure from heretofore accepted practice and precedent. Second, I will describe how the statute is supposed to work, focusing on the powers that Congress granted to CMS to regulate the prices on certain drug and biological products. Third, I'll provide an overview of the most significant claims that have been raised in the litigation, both the constitutional and the statutory claims, and the defenses that have been raised by the government. And fourth, I'll provide a brief update on where the litigation stands, and then we'll close with some thoughts on policy and obviously answer any questions any of you might have. So let me start off with a little bit background. As I see it, broadly stated, the Constitution is designed to try to balance two interests. One, the interests of the majority, while at the same time protecting the rights of disfavored minorities. If you think about that in broad terms, the Constitution protects the interests of the majority by ensuring that Congress is accountable to the people for the laws that it enacts. There are many relevant constitutional provisions, but obvious examples include the separation of powers, which ensure, for example, that legislative powers, the power to create new substantive obligations and law, resides only with elected representatives. And the First Amendment is another example, which helps to ensure political accountability by guaranteeing that citizens have the right of free speech and prohibit the government from compelling speech. At the same time, the Constitution not only protects these broad public interests, it also protects the interests of disfavored minorities by protecting private rights. And there's lots of provisions in the Constitution that you can think of that do that. The due process and equal protection guarantees, the Constitution's many prohibitions against legislative targeting, and including the prohibitions against government takings and the imposition of excessive fines. Now, as we all know, the traditional constitutional system changed somewhat dramatically in the New Deal. And since 1946, executive branch agencies have been given leeway to make new law and impose new legal requirements through rulemaking. But that power has always been accompanied by certain somewhat modest limits, which are also designed to protect these two values, one, the public interest, and two, the private rights. So Congress cannot delegate authority to an agency unless it articulates an intelligible principle to constrain the agency's discretion. Agencies must proceed through a public notice and comment process when trying to implement new substantive rules that go beyond the statute's plain text. An agency action is subject to judicial review to ensure that the agency is complying with Congress's commands and that the agency is not acting in an arbitrary and unreasonable manner. So I mention all of these background principles because I think it sets up the Inflation Reduction Act, which, as it has been implemented by the government and in particular by CMS, tries to avoid these traditional constraints, both by blurring the lines of accountability and by eliminating the protections for the public interest and private rights that are guaranteed under the traditionally guaranteed under the Administrative Procedure Act. So the statute has two main sets of provisions. The first defines which specific drug and biological products are subject to price controls, and the second addresses how CMS should set prices. Let me talk about both of those. So starting with the first set of provision, the statute is quite complicated, but it has this process for determining which products are subject to price controls. And it's supposed to work in generally a sort of a three-step process. First, it defines a universe of products known as qualifying single-source drugs, or just those products that qualify for price controls. And in order to do that, Congress made clear that a drug product has to be on the market at least 7 years since it was approved by FDA and marketed, and is not subject to generic competition. And second, a biological product has to be on the market for at least 11 years since it was approved by FDA and not subject to biosimilar competition. So in determining this universe of products, the agency is supposed to look at only products that have been on the market for 7 years in the case of drug products or 11 years in the case of biological products and are not subject to competition from generics or biosimilars. And then Congress also gave CMS the discretion to narrow this universe by excluding certain products that are designated to treat rare diseases or that involve what the statute refers to as low-spend products. Once it has come up with this universe of qualifying products, it's then supposed to identify which products are eligible for price controls. And those, what it's supposed to do there, what the statute refers to as, quote, negotiation-eligible products. The statute requires CMS to identify the top 50 products in the nation according to how much is spent on them. And then again, it grants CMS authority to create exceptions for certain products that qualify for what the statute calls small biotech drugs. And then finally, after the agency has first identified the universe of products and then narrowed it to 50 eligible products, it's supposed to rank those different products and select certain products for price controls. In 2026, it's entitled to impose price controls on no more than 10 products. And then that number slowly increases over time. In 2027 and 28, it's 15 products. And in 2029, it increases to 20 products. So Congress authorized CMS to impose price controls under the Inflation Reduction Act, but not all at once, and only in a limited number of products that have been on the market for a specified period of time. In addition to all this, it's worth noting that Congress also specifically denied CMS any rulemaking authority to add new or other substantive legal requirements. So in other places in the Inflation Reduction Act and in many other statutes, Congress will specifically say that the agency has rulemaking authority and also authority to proceed by guidance, or it won't say anything at all, in which courts often interpret that as an implicit grant of authority. But here, Congress made specifically clear in the statute that for the first 3 years of the program, CMS would have to implement the program through the, implement the statute and its price control program through programmatic guidance and instruction. So that's the first set of provisions that lay out what products are supposed to be subject to price controls. And then the second set of provisions in the statute relate to price. Now, the statute has been advertised and sold as a quote-unquote negotiation process, the idea being that the government and manufacturers are negotiating a mutually agreeable fair price and what the statute refers to as what the parties might agree upon as a maximum fair price. But if you look at the statute, there really is no such thing as a negotiation process in any ordinary sense of the term. Instead, what the statute imposes is a ceiling price. And then CMS engages in a one-sided information gathering process where it compels manufacturers to turn over sensitive and confidential information that they ordinarily would not share with a contracting partner. The statute then gives CMS unfettered discretion to impose any price that it wants under the ceiling price, and it requires manufacturers to express their agreement that any price imposed by CMS is, quote unquote, the maximum fair price that could be charged for the product. Although CMS is supposed to consider certain factors when it goes through this one-sided process, there is no standard that the statute applies to cabin the agency's discretion. The statutory term maximum fair price is defined to mean, in the statute, whatever price the agency sets. There are no procedures that the agency must follow. It can do whatever it wants. There's no administrative hearing, and there's no judicial review. And so it's not a true negotiation in any sense of the word, because manufacturers really have no choice once they participate in the program. In fact, the statute imposes a penalty on any manufacturer that tries to leave the program, a 1,900% tax penalty that, as a practical matter, results in tens of billions of dollars and no manufacturer could afford to pay. Now, in implementing the statute, the CMS has taken a number of positions that reflect an expansive view of its authority and our attempt to protect the statute from being struck down on constitutional grounds. First, the agency has tried to ameliorate the concerns raised by the fact that this statute imposes an impossible penalty on any manufacturer that tries to leave the negotiation process, and has done that by saying that in its discretion, it will allow manufacturers to exit. But with an important caveat, manufacturers are not able to just leave the program with a single product that's been selected for price controls. Instead, at least under existing CMS rules, although there's some lack of clarity over this, the CMS has taken the position that manufacturers must exit all of their products from Medicare and Medicaid all at the same time. So as you can imagine, given the growth in government programs and the vast majority of patients that obtain their medications through either Medicare or the federal Medicaid programs, the ability to actually withdraw an entire portfolio from the government programs is almost impossible. Second, instead of implementing the program through programmatic guidance and instruction as Congress directed, CMS has decided to implement the statute by imposing new binding requirements. It has interpreted Congress's command to proceed by guidance as a carte blanche to impose any new substantive requirements at once, but without going through the APA's ordinary notice and comment requirements. So essentially, it has adopted guidance documents that it has conceded include new substantive requirements that would otherwise have to be implemented through rulemaking. But it interprets Congress's command to proceed by guidance as authority to do exactly that. And then third, instead of limiting price controls to 10 products in 2026, it has grouped together all products that are manufactured by the same manufacturer and that contain either the same active ingredient or the same active moiety. In doing this, what it has done is greatly expanded the statute. So instead of applying to products that have only been on the market for 7 or 11 years since FDA approval, it is sweeping in a large number of products that have not been on the market for that long and have been treated by FDA as separate products that treat separate diseases and serve separate patient populations, merely because the underlying active ingredient or active moiety is the same. So that's the background on how the statute operates. And with that background, I wanted to provide a quick overview of the claims that have been raised by the parties and also the defenses that have been raised by the government. As I'll explain in a little more detail later, there is significant litigation that is currently pending in the 2nd, 3rd, 5th, 6th, and DC circuits. And while the complaints are all different in focus and emphasis, the major claims, I think, I can summarize fairly easily. So in the constitutional claims, the first is that the statute violates the takings clause, because it is forcing manufacturers to provide access to the products to beneficiaries of government Medicare and Medicaid programs. The key to this claim, which is not raised by all of the plaintiffs and manufacturers that are challenging the IRA, but by several of them, is that the government is not just regulating the price of the product, it is effectively taking control of the products and forcing the sale to beneficiaries. And I won't go through all the details, but if you look at the statute operates in a way that it doesn't just say that this is a price control that will be imposed, but rather what it does is it requires that the manufacturers provide access to these products, and then essentially says that any beneficiary, any patient that wants to access those products is entitled to do so at the price that is set by CMS. The second set of claims, again, not raised by all of the manufacturer plaintiffs, but by some of them, is that the statute violates the separation of powers and due process because it delegates sweeping authority to the government agency to impose any price it wants below the statutory ceiling price, but it includes no articulated standards to cabin the agency's discretion. There are no procedures that the agency must follow to ensure that the price it imposes is constitutionally appropriate or that it's reasonable and not arbitrary in any way. And the statute prohibits judicial review to prevent the judiciary from checking to make sure that the price imposed is permissible or reasonable. Significantly, in the course of litigation, the government has never identified any statute that has been like this. Even during wartime, when price controls were imposed during World War II, the price controls had statutes that were imposed had more due process protections, more availability of administrative or judicial review, and at least something in the way of a judicially enforceable standard that could be applied to ensure that the prices were imposed were just, reasonable, and non-arbitrary. The third set of claims that have been raised in the cases relates to the First Amendment. The statute forces manufacturers to participate in this negotiation process and then requires them to sign an agreement saying that they agree that the price imposed by CMS is, quote unquote, the maximum fair price. The manufacturers argue that that is compelled speech, and it is quite clear from the legislative record that the statements that the statute was specifically included this compelled speech requirement because it was designed to put manufacturers in the position of having to say that any higher price than the price that CMS imposed would be unfair and an inappropriate price. And in that way, the statute was designed not only to regulate the 50 or 60 million patients or the sales to 60 million patients that participate in the government programs, but also to have a spillover effect in the private commercial markets. And then finally, the last constitutional claim that has been raised, again, by only some of the manufacturer plaintiffs and not all, is an argument that the statute violates the excessive fines provision. Although the 1900% penalty that is imposed on any manufacturer that tries to leave the program is labeled an excise tax, it doesn't function as a tax. It's not supposed to raise any revenues. And instead, it's designed solely to be a fine that penalizes manufacturers for leaving the program. In that sense, the fine is not imposed for any wrongdoing or any misconduct. It's only designed to force manufacturers to remain in participating with the government in the program. And the penalty is disproportional to any valid basis that might exist for imposing a penalty. Again, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars that are designed to ensure that no manufacturer can leave. In addition to those constitutional claims, there are at least two statutory claims that have been raised, also challenging how CMS has chosen to implement the program. Those statutory claims in many ways are a reflection of the constitutional claims. So the first claim is that the agency has violated the statute's mandate that it should proceed only by guidance for the first 3 years. When Congress directs an agency to proceed by guidance, the term guidance is a term of art that means non-binding, non-substantive requirements, similar to interpretive rules. It does not include the authority to impose new sub-binding substantive requirements, that is, impose new regulations. And it certainly doesn't exempt the agency from complying with the requirements of the Administrative Procedure Act, which apply unless Congress expressly states that it doesn't. Here, the argument is that by admittedly imposing new substantive requirements that go beyond what the statute authorizes, through essentially creating new binding regulatory requirements that manufacturers must comply with, the agency has violated the statute's guidance-only mandate. Second statutory argument that has been raised is that the agency is violating the statute's 10-product limit. When Congress made clear that CMS could only impose price controls on 10 products in the first year, that's in 2026, and slowly increase over time, and that those products had to be on the market for 7 or 11 years, depending on whether they are drugs or biological products, and only if they weren't subject to competition, those were meaningful limits on the agency's authority to impose price controls. Nowhere in the statute does Congress refer to active ingredients or active moiety. Those terms are made up by CMS as a way of evading the statutory requirements so that they can, in fact, impose price controls on far more than 10 products in 2026 and lump together different products that have been approved by FDA at different times and for different therapeutic purposes and treat them all as a single group of products subject to price controls. So those are the affirmative claims that have been raised by manufacturers. Now, of course, the government rejects all of those claims and has specific responses to each of them. But what I'll do is just focus on what I think are its main defenses and the defenses that have been largely a focus of the courts that have considered these issues so far, particularly the district courts that have issued their decisions. So the government's first position is that there are no private rights at stake, so no concerns under constitutional provisions such as the Takings Clause or the Due Process Clause, because the government is merely exercising procurement-like powers. In its view, the program is no different from when the government purchases products for itself as a market participant. Now, the challenge for this position is twofold. One is that the Supreme Court has held in related contexts involving a state regulation, that a state government is not a mere market participant when it is also exercising regulatory powers that no market participant could exercise. It also seems clear that this general rule that applies to when the government acts as a market participant should not apply when, as a result of exercising regulatory powers, the government has taken control over an entire market, in this case, a market for some 50 to 60 million people. Having said that, that is a relatively untested proposition as it applies to the federal government. And so far, courts have not grappled with the question as to whether this is a legitimate exercise of the government acting merely as a market participant, or whether it is actually regulating these prices for consumers for its benefit. Second, the government argues that the program is entirely voluntarily. So what the government says is that manufacturers essentially waive their constitutional rights by agreeing to participate. This is the argument that has largely been accepted by the district courts to date, based on a series of precedents that go back about 10 to 15 years old, before the government exercised such a large dominating position in the healthcare markets, but where it said that when an entity, a hospital or a provider, is involved in a government healthcare program, it has a choice as to whether to participate or not. Now, what's interesting here and the issues that really are teed up is that none of the courts so far that have considered this issue or agreed that the program is voluntary have addressed a couple of arguments that have been presented. First, that even if the program is voluntary, that doesn't solve the structural problems with the statute that are designed to protect the public interest. In particular, it doesn't address separation of powers concerns, and it doesn't address other structural constitutional protections that are designed not to protect just private rights, but the broader public interest in ensuring government accountability. Second, it is clear that the statute was enacted to be coercive and that manufacturers are not permitted to leave the program without withdrawing all of their products. The Supreme Court has said in other contexts that when government exercises these types of coercive sovereign powers, it cannot be said to be implementing a voluntary program. That was most famously said by the Supreme Court in the NFIB Supreme Court litigation relating the litigation over the Affordable Care Act. But that is also has not yet been addressed in any details by the courts that are considering challenges to the Inflation Reduction Act. And third, the government argues that the challenges to its exercise of statutory, interpretation of the statute to allow to aggregate multiple products together is not subject to judicial review because the statute contains judicial review bars. And the government argues that those judicial review bars should be interpreted broadly to encompass not only which products to exempt from price controls in the funneling process that the statute sets out, and its calculation of which products satisfy certain spending requirements to be subject to price controls, but also to allow it to change the number of products that Congress said should be subject to price controls. So to increase it from 10 products to much more than that, I think 15 or 16 in 2026 and more than 15 in 2027 and 2028. Now, case law says that judicial review bars should be interpreted narrowly with a strong presumption in favor of judicial review. And if CMS is correct, what this means is that it's unfettered authority to do whatever it wants with no specific direction by Congress and no review by the courts. Nonetheless, this is also an untested area that has not been addressed by any of the courts in any detail in the pending litigation. So where do things stand right now? Well, there are a number of cases that remain pending. There are four cases before the Third Circuit. Those cases have been filed by Novo Nordisk, Novartis, BMS, and Janssen. The Third Circuit has decided one case on standing grounds. That was a separate case that was filed by AstraZeneca. But it is yet to decide the remaining four cases. Two of those cases were argued on October 30th of last year. And the two remaining cases were argued on April 8th in 2025, and the parties are now waiting for decisions. There is one case that's pending before the Second Circuit. That's the case that was brought by Boehringer. And arguments in that case were heard on April 3rd of this year. And again, the parties are waiting for a decision. There is one case that is pending before the Sixth Circuit that was brought by Chambers of Commerce in Ohio and the National Chamber of Commerce. That case is focused narrowly only on the question of associational standing. If the chamber prevails in that appeal, it will then likely go back to the district court for a further decision on the merits. That argument was heard on June 11th, and the parties are still waiting for a decision. There is one case in the Western District of Texas that's been filed by Pharma. That case was initially dismissed by the district court. It went up on appeal to the Fifth Circuit. The court was reversed, and it's now back before the district court where it's waiting for a decision on the merits of the constitutional claims. And there are two cases in the District of Columbia, one filed by Merck and one filed by Teva, that are still waiting for decisions by the district court. And once those decisions are issued, we expect appeals to the DC Circuit. So it seems likely that we should see decisions reasonably soon, perhaps at the end of the summer or certainly towards the end of 2025. And then depending on how the cases are decided, it would not be surprising to see the parties try to take these cases up to the Supreme Court. I would say just a few more words and then I'll pause and open it up for any questions that anyone might have. I think there are many folks that are hoping that the Supreme Court might weigh in on these cases because how significant they are. Regardless of which side of the case you're on, whether you're in favor of price controls under the Inflation Reduction Act or whether you're opposed to them, it's certainly clear that these cases represent a significant change in administrative power that goes beyond what has been permitted in the past. Most significantly, this is part of a trend with the government exercising powers under its spending powers to essentially argue that when the government sets up a program that it funds and then uses those funds to, as in a way, to subsidize operations, that it can then regulate participants in the program in a fairly heavy-handed and aggressive way without being subject to the usual restrictions that you'd expect under either the Constitution or the procedural protections that since 1946 have applied under the Administrative Procedure Act. It's interesting to consider that whatever you think of price controls, the significance of this position could be quite significant for other markets too. It's not difficult to imagine that concerns about, for example, housing prices, food prices, or other commodity prices could be easily addressed by the government setting itself up as a regulatory middleman that requires anybody who's seeking to sell their house or a product or a commodity to go through the government and to sell the price at whatever price the government dictates and provide it to consumers at the government's demand. More broadly, I think, specifically focusing on the Inflation Reduction Act, as the statute has been implemented, the price controls still are not in effect. They won't take effect until 2026. There are growing concerns about the consequences of CMS's actions for innovation, particularly because CMS, instead of limiting itself to 10 specific products, as it has lumped products together, there's a sense that the program is moving much more quickly than ever expected, which is having a significant consequence for innovation in new products and basically the ability for competitor products to come online. Obviously, when Congress enacted the statute, it was expecting that the price controls would be helpful for products that had not yet received competition in a way that might spur competition. But at least the initial studies are suggesting that it's having the opposite effect. And in fact, what it's doing is it's having an impact that's restricting generic and biosimilar competition in a way that's not helpful. Obviously, the consequences of that will not be heard for many years, but that takes me back to sort of my more controversial perspective on the Constitution, which is one of the reasons why you enforce these constitutional restrictions is to ensure that there's accountability for the decisions that Congress makes and that there's a clear line of judicial review to make sure that agency is complying with Congress's commands. In this statute, and at least as it's been interpreted and implemented so far, that has not been the case. But as I mentioned, the district courts so far have not been receptive to the challenges. They have deferred broadly to the government's position, and we will wait to see whether any of the appellate courts are going to enforce the constitutional requirements or whether they will be receptive to the government's broad claims that by setting this up in the way that they have, the program can be labeled a voluntary negotiation, and that is sufficient to eliminate the constitutional and administrative law restrictions that would otherwise apply. So with that, Caroline, if I can pause and leave it to open up for any questions or comments you or others might have.
Definitely. Well, thank you, Ashley, for that presentation. That was very thorough and useful. So the first question we have is, someone wants to know, how do you reconcile kind of Federalist principles of freedom of contracts with the government argument that drug makers freely and voluntarily choose to participate in Medicare and Medicaid programs? Isn't the government's position simply a freedom of contract issue? Don't several drug makers not participate in those federal healthcare programs themselves? So any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a few things. First, I would say that if that were true, the statute wouldn't have been set up the way that it was. There would have been no need for a penalty to stop them from leaving at will. There would be no need for CMS to tie the products together to say that you're either all in or all out. And there would be no need for a First Amendment restriction that says that you must agree that it's the maximum fair price, because if it was truly a free freedom of contract principles, you'd be free to say whatever you'd want and you'd be free to walk away from the practice. Now, we know that in the private context, which doesn't apply to the government, there are antitrust principles. But what I would suggest is that the reason why you have antitrust principles is that you want to prevent private market participants from taking over a monopoly or monopsony position in a market so that there can actually be freedom of contract and so forth. The constitutional restrictions on things like takings and due process are in some ways analogous to how the antitrust principles are supposed to work in the private markets, which is that the government is allowed to, if it's acting as a true market participant, have a take it or leave it process. But if it isn't and it's putting a regulatory thumb on the scale, then it has to at least comply with the constitutional requirements of ensuring due process, no takings, and separation of powers. And so the problem here is that drug makers can't simply exit the programs, and instead they're essentially coerced into doing it. Now, it is true that there are some smaller drug makers that don't participate. The problem here is that the products that are being selected are those of the highest spend, which means that in order for a drug maker to leave the program, they would have to essentially abandon, you know, potentially millions of patients. One way to look at that is that says, well, you know, you're out of luck, you just don't have access to the market. But another way to look at it from an ethical perspective is no one wants to see these patients without access to the drugs that they need.
Great. Another question, isn't the drug industry's position here, is it contrary to the Trump administration's goal of equalizing discriminatory price differentials between the prices drug makers impose on U.S. purchasers and the prices they impose on purchasers in foreign developed nation states? Do you see any political fallout from the Trump administration for such challenges?
Well, I think there's two issues there. I do think that there's the Trump administration's executive orders are talking about most favored nation pricing, which hasn't been implemented yet, but there's a broader invitation for manufacturers to engage in that. In contrast, this is relating specifically to the Inflation Reduction Act. I do think there are some concerns that the administration might use the Inflation Reduction Act as a way to impose what they view as most favored nation pricing through this process on the drugs that are selected. But I would say those are two different things. And I think that the interest in imposing price controls for the Inflation Reduction Act is separate from the question of imposing most favored nation pricing, although they might collapse. What I do think it shows, though, is that, and, you know, again, the courts have not been receptive at the district court level, but one question you would want to ask yourself as a judge would be, can I read this statute and understand conceptually, not specifically, but what is the intelligible conceptual principle or standard that I should apply to see that the price that is being imposed is consistent with Congress's commands? And the problem here is that all that Congress has done is set a ceiling and then said anything below that, CMS can do whatever it wants. And that, I think, raises the fundamental concern is that even in the non-delegation cases that we've had in the past, there has always been at least some intelligible principle, and that's been married with procedures under the APA and along with a judicial review to ensure that at least those intelligible principles are enforced. So we can see in the regulatory context relating to energy, for example, prices have to be just and reasonable. And there's a whole body of case law that is developed where courts explain what just and reasonable means in light of constitutional requirements. Here, there's nothing like that. If CMS is able to apply the statute, what it means is it can do anything it wants. MMF pricing, penny pricing, or anything in between.
Very helpful. Another question, and you might have addressed this a little bit, but do you see Congress stepping in to adjust the statutory framework depending on litigation outcomes?
You know, I think that's very difficult. I do think there's always been this question that has come up with a conversation between the courts in Congress. And the question being is how much should courts say, well, what Congress has done is good enough, or how much should courts say what Congress has done is not sufficient and send it back? And I think, you know, in today's world, the debilities of Congress, the idea that it's not able to act very efficiently, often weighs in that balance. My own personal view on this is that the right approach for courts is to recognize that Congress has broad discretion to impose these types of programs, but it has to comply with constitutional requirements to ensure accountability. So if Congress, for example, tomorrow wanted to say, we've identified what we believe are the top 10 drugs, and we are going to impose the falling price or the falling formula for a price. And all of the public could recognize that what Congress had done is impose those price controls. And then that the people could take a look at that. And to the extent that it impacted innovation or their access to other medications or otherwise, they could blame Congress. That would be a perfectly acceptable and constitutional program. What the concern with the IRA is that it doesn't do that. Everything is sort of a misnomer. It calls it a negotiation, but it's not a negotiation. It's a forced cram down. It says it's an excise tax, but it's not a tax. It's a successive penalty. And the question, I think, for the courts is whether that's permissible within these general concepts of voluntariness and the exercise of government spending powers, or whether there are some restrictions on what Congress can do in this area.
Great. Well, if there are no other questions, Ashley, I just want to thank you for the benefit of your time and expertise today. This has been terrific. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.